Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham, and I do hope you weren't talking about me, Lewis. Oh, I'm in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Well, the good guys finally got another league win under our belts after taking all 3 points in a pulsating game against Forest at the Tissy Ground. But it was a game not without controversy both on and off the pitch. First, Lewis Dunk became our second player in 2 games to see red after more than the season without any players taking an early bath. And we also saw our already lengthy injury list get worse with both Ansu Fati and Tarek Lamptey limp out of the action. That leaves us incredibly short of bodies heading into Thursday's game in Athens as we look to avenge our first day defeat and look to qualify the next stage. And then on Sunday, we make the first of 3 trips to the capital in December against Chelsea. That's assuming you can get there with the trains decimated. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wes. We welcome back journalist, author, musician Nick Trepanic. And we're also delighted to welcome back Vicky Reeves. Hello, everybody. It's busy time for us, isn't it?
Hi, Eddie.
Yeah, it's always busy for the Albion and Albion fans. But these weeks are taking the biscuit. Yes, yeah, straight back from an international break to all this.
It's just mad. I mean, ordinarily we'd be gung-ho to get out to Chelsea, particularly with our current relationship with them. But obviously we've got a little trip to Athens to look forward to first, Vicky.
I know, can't wait. This one's my European away debut, personally, because I haven't been able to make the other 2 away games, so I'm very excited, apart from the early start in the morning.
Let's start at Forest, because, I mean, there's a lot to get through there. And, Vicky, I mean, you made the journey north. I mean, Nottingham's always a brilliant place to go to, but it was a bit of an interesting experience this time around, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I think I've travelled more in hope than expectation, really, which is always a good thing, because then it's less likely to mean disappointment at the end, isn't it? But, after a less than promising start, we actually played quite well in the end. I thought, we were decent, we deserved the win. And what was really nice was we ground that win out in a quite un-Albion-like way, or at least a quite undeserby-like way, because I think that's not been our specialism, has it, in the last year or so, hanging on. We've had games recently where we should have won, we could have won, we should have won, and just haven't been able to see it through. So actually, once they got that penalty back and the crowd really got behind them for the first time in the game, it was quite tense, and it was just brilliant to see them hanging on and throwing bodies in the weapon.
I mean, in terms of these stadiums that we go to, I mean, the City Ground is always one that is a lot more raucous than, say, Man City, Nick.
Yeah, it's an old stadium. That stadium's been there for a long time, and the Trent End's built up a bit of a reputation. I thought they were slightly milking you, weren't they, with all their songs about how wonderful the City Ground is, to the tune of Mull of Kintyre. I mean, there's plenty of loud ends in football, they've had a chance to sort of bed in there over 100 years. The funny thing, though, I mean, they're very raucous for a team that basically, apart from just a few years when a couple of guys who were once at the Goldstone were in charge, they never actually
that was very nice
league title, 2 European Cups and a couple of League Cups, and nothing before or since. I think they won an FA Cup in 1959. And somehow they sort of see themselves as a huge club on the strength of that small period of success. But good luck to them. They're more success in terms of winning stuff than we have. So fair play.
Listen, if we won the Champions League, I think we'd gloat for a short while. Well, for probably about 50 years afterwards. So fair play. Yeah. And they did actually finish runners up in the league in 1966. That much I know as well. So
second place, first loser, mate.
Yeah. Rock Hall for second, as my brother once sang to Cardiff City in 2001.
Ordinarily in these sort of things, I would go through all the team changes, but under the Zerbi, I just can't be bothered these days.
It's quicker to actually just name the players that carry on playing.
But two players who did start the game, Vicky,
were Ansu Fati and Tarek Lamptey. We don't necessarily always start guys, and obviously Tarek just coming back from injury. So to add to our already crippling injury list is disappointing, isn't it?
It was, and I think, well, there was a point in the first half when Ferguson went down as well, and you could just sort of almost hear the air being draining out of the away end. But there was a point, I think, just after when Lamptey went down as well, which, you know, I appreciate isn't always an unusual thing, but when he went down as well, people, you know, a lot of people in Iran were singing "Stand Up If You Brought Your Boots." I suppose there's a little bit of adversity there, maybe galvanized them a little bit. Obviously, we ended up with a lot of square pegs in round holes at the end, but, you know, it was great to see Modder come back. Clearly, he's going to be a little bit rusty. He's, you know, hasn't had a pre-season in the old cliche, but. He's a big lad, Mother. You forget that. You forget how tall he is. And suddenly at the end there, when it was all hands to the pump, he was winning some really good headers in the box.
Vicky's point there about square pegs and round holes, doesn't it actually sort of kind of highlight the point about De Zerbi's system or the way that he's got his team and all the players doing what they're doing? Now, they all have to be versatile. And yes, we've got, you know, Jack Hinchwell playing here and Wananotti playing there and Pascal Gross, well, it won't be long before he's in goal. But it's actually more to do with the system. And yes, while you'll have players who are better at left back or better in central midfield or better strikers than they would be a right winger or a centre back or whatever it is, the way that so many players are versatile enough to slot into a given role and do a job, you can still see that sort of Jack Hinchwood is very much a work in progress.
Mm.
And there were a couple of sort of whoopsies that he undertook, but I've no idea, to be honest, at the moment, what his best position is. He was found slightly wanting against Villa a few weeks ago. Performed okay against Forest at left back, but it's all to do with the system. It seems to be, Nick, I don't know what you think about this, that the system is king.
Well, quite a number of players when they've been asked about the De Zerbi and what he's brought to the club, have mentioned that you not only understand your role on the pitch, but you know what everybody else is supposed to be doing at the same time. And when you have it micromanaged to that degree, then presumably if, let's say, you know, Joel Veltman knows where Billy Gilmour is supposed to be, you know, when he plays a pass, then if you are now suddenly told that you've got to play in the Billy Gilmour role, at least you know where he's supposed to be and what he's supposed to be doing and what his part in the build-up is. So presumably, you know, players are able to fit into lots of different positions. I'm not suggesting, you know, that Lewis Dunk could play the Mitoma role, but I think at least he'd know what the Mitoma role was. So I think that probably gives them a head start. And you've got players, you know, who can be two-footed and versatile and intelligent, you know, then... you've got an advantage there. And of course, if you know, you know, the whole team pattern, not just what you're supposed to be doing, then you've got half a chance if people have to be moved around.
Yeah. Nick, I just want to backtrack to the injuries there a little bit. Now, obviously, we lost Tarek on Saturday. We haven't heard the reports about how bad it is or how long he's going to be likely to be out again. But we also lost Purvis, which could be a long-term injury as well. I mean, are we guilty of rushing these players back because we are so short of fullbacks?
Well, you have to assume that Roberto De Zerbi has taken advice from the medical staff, on how fit these guys are. I very much doubt if he will be wanting to rush people back because he's always very respectful of the medical staff. So. It could be that the players want to play. We know that Pascal Gross, you know, doesn't want to miss any games, would like to play every minute if he possibly can. It's very hard. I mean, do you want to risk, you know, losing points because you've got to play someone at left back who isn't up to the job or doesn't, you know, is stepping up from the under-21s, or do you want to try to fit someone in there if they say they're willing to give it a go? Only thing that worries me about Lamptey is he's going to be one of those players who's just never fit.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that possibly we got Danny Welbeck fit after an operation, but you know he's out again. Not blaming any of the players, of course, but sometimes and you see this with players of the Lamptey type who rely on acceleration. You know, that puts such a strain on thigh muscles, hamstrings, lower backs, you know, calves and everything. And once that those muscles start to go, you know, that sort of house of cards effect can take place. I mean, Michael Owen had a terrible time, you know, and his game was based on acceleration, and he spent long periods unfit with similar types of injuries. And I just worry about Lamptey from that point of view.
Yeah. Now, Vicky, I mean, obviously, another slight worry is obviously we had Jakub Mohda come back from a long-term injury. First time he's played under Zerbi. Now, when he was playing, when he got the injury, it was against Norwich, wasn't it? And under Graham Potter, he was actually playing fullback. So, I mean, it's a worry that we've got another player coming back from long-term injury. That's a fullback and could actually play at fullback, sorry.
I think as you touched on before, it's probably more about the system. I mean, De Zerbi's never played him at fullback. I would imagine with Mohda they will be treating him, you know, very carefully. He had that initial serious injury, but there was a number of setbacks following on from that. So, you know, and for him as well, he's got to get over the mental hurdle, because that's what happens to a lot of players, isn't it? When they've had a serious injury, especially when, you know, he's been out for 19 months. There's going to be a big mental hurdle for him to get over, to just know that those challenges are going to be okay. So I imagine they'll be nursing him through, you know, to a great extent. Whether, you know, he's not going to be playing 90 minutes anytime soon, I don't think. So they're not necessarily going to just chuck him in at left back or right back and just risk him against some, you know, speedy winger.
Yes. I mean, to throw him in a game like that on Saturday when it was all hands to the pump, they must have been fairly confident he was quite robust.
Yeah, I'm sure they were. And actually, he did fine. You know, there was a couple of moments where I think he gave the ball away, but then you could say that about most of them. And, you know, as we've said towards the end there, it was just a sort of, you know, case of getting everything in the way. To be honest, I didn't really think Forest looked like scoring for all the pressure they had. And you know, we knew there was going to be a massive amount of added time from all the VAR checks and everything. You know, so the 10 minutes added wasn't a huge surprise, but yes, it was all hands to the pump, but I didn't feel that they really looked like scoring. I think there was one save from Verbruggen near the end, which, you know, good save. You know, you kind of hope he's going to make it.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Sorry, Nick.
I was just going back to the old North Stand standard answer to everything about a player we never heard of: can he play left back? And that, you know, that was possibly the question when De Zerbi was throwing players on in the second half in Nottingham. You know, that there was, I think, Josh Doofus was on the bench, but it was one of the central defenders from the under-21s. I mean, Mohda possibly, you know, was a better bet than Carlos Baleba for left back. Was he difficult? Well, there are a couple of under-21 left backs. The kid we got from Preston in the summer, I think perhaps he's going to be appearing on a bench close to us at some point. But it's just a question of who could possibly be put on in those situations.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the game there. And obviously Forest took an early lead. I'm really glad that Joel Veltman's got his GPS back, because, you know, he went missing for that first goal.
Yeah,
he was drawn into the middle, wasn't he? He was drawn into Chris Wood, and the guy was left at the far post. It was terrible defending on both sides from the Albion. I mean, the guy who brought the ball forward had the absolute freedom of the right.
Yeah, it was Gibbs' right. He had the freedom of the City ground to maraud down the right flank.
He was caught too far upfield.
I was about to say, who was chasing him back? You know, Mr. Slow-mo. I mean, don't get me wrong, I absolutely love Pascal Gross, but, you know, I mean, I know AD uses the phrase, it looks like he's running on Baywatch, but I'd say it looks like more like running on treacle. So, yeah, Gibbs White was also going to go sailing past him. So, yeah, to be fair, it was a very good cross. I mean, he picked out his man really well, bypassed the marks Chris Wood and picked out his man well. I mean, if that would have been on our side, you'd have said, you know, Lamptey or whoever it was that would have crossed it, you think, brilliantly picked out, superb.
Yeah, but you would question the defending, though, because, I mean, like you said, Veltman got drawn into the middle. There's no one, like Lamptey got caught up the pitch. There was no one covering. I mean, I think there was Adingra was there trying to chase back as well. He got caught up upfield. And, you know, there was so much time and space for Gibbs White to actually pick his man. It was ridiculous.
But this is the whole philosophy of Roberto De Zerbi, isn't it? I mean, I think Kamikaze is probably putting it a bit too strong, but there are times when you do have to think, well, actually, maybe is it worth actually dropping back 10 yards? Because all it took was one slightly straight pass. And well, it wasn't even necessarily a straight pass. It was well intercepted, but it was a pass that should have made its way through.
Mm.
And all that's all it took. And after that, pow, Forrester away in a way that we normally would be. So, I mean, if anything, it is a Brighton-esque goal. But that's what happens when you've got so many players so far up the pitch. That's what's going to happen.
No, Vicky, we've scored in every game this season, but we've still not kept a clean sheet in the league, at least. Is that a concern for you?
It's always a concern, isn't it? I mean, but it's that question of, you know, would you accept a 0-0 or would you, you know, as soon as we accept a 0-0, we say, well, we don't want to, you know, we're happy with not scoring anymore. So I think just the way that De Zerbi sets up, and I think this was the same when he was the manager of Sassuolo, wasn't it? That his teams were renowned for playing like this. It makes for fun. It makes it additionally tense when it's late on in the game and you're hanging on to a lead. But I don't know. Can you have one without the other with the way he plays? Would we be as fun to watch if it wasn't for the jeopardy of the... You know, can we be... You know, for argument's sake, are we going to go full Roy Hodgson at the back? Do you take the fun and the joy away from the attacking? I don't know.
As well, I think when we signed him, I spoke to an Italian journalist who said that with Sassuolo, you know, they could win 8-0 one week and lose 8-0 the next. And we haven't sunk to that level. I mean, we got one thrashing at Aston Villa when it all went wrong and everything went in the net. But I think the thing is that he's dealing with better defenders than he was dealing with at Sassuolo, and so, you know, the quality of our defenders overcomes the weakness in that and the flaw in that system, I think. So long way that continue. If we've got any defenders,
but it's also the Newcastle as well. If there are games that saw it went a bit with definitely.
No, absolutely, yes, you're right.
No, is that? I mean, the thing is that oddly enough, our defenders are judged by what they're like on the ball, not off the ball. I mean, I know we'll talk about sort of like the last 15 minutes after Lewis Dunk's red card in a bit. But if you compare and contrast how floppily at sea they were as soon as Dahoud got his red card against Sheffield United, wasn't it? You know,
I wonder. I mean, it's a sort of truism that all teams practice defending 10 against 11 or 9 against 11. I don't know if Albion team does, because they didn't seem terribly good at it. And I think it was Mitoma, wasn't it? Didn't track his man against Sheffield United. And some of our attacking players are not brilliant at the defensive side of the game.
Yeah. I mean, it's the fact that we hadn't had a player sent off for a whole, well, more than a season. It was
about 60 games, I think it was. I mean, we used to do it all the time under Gus, because we were always getting players sent off. And, you know, I think back to that Charlton game at home where Calder got sent off in about the 8th minute. And it was 10 against 11. We could have actually won it because that team was so well drilled in 10 against 11. Because, because we just got so many red cards. Like you say, it's
about the Burnley game when we nearly pulled off a draw
with Rodriguez and,
yeah. Yeah, it was Roman Vanslow and Ashley Barnes.
Ashley Barnes.
Yeah. And like I say, it's been 60 games. And, yeah, they looked totally lost at sea. Although this time, and I know we'll discuss it, they were a lot better. And as Vicky said, I mean, you can be wise after the event because you think all it takes is one slip, one miscued clearance, one fumble. Yeah, like you say, apart from that save, it's not as though they peppered the goal at the end of the game, was it?
No, but well, we didn't exactly pepper the goal ourselves. But one person who did find the back of the net was Evan Ferguson. And Nick, what a wonderful finish that was.
Yeah, I mean, he's... For a big guy, you know, you would expect him to be sort of heading goals and everything, but he's got an absolutely fantastic, you know, range of skills on the ground. He can, you know, he can come short. He could almost play as a number 10 if he had to. And the thing is, what he does is he hits the ball very quickly. He doesn't mess around. I mean, a lot of his goals are taken very early, first or second touch, gets the ball out of his feet with one touch and hits it with another. That goal he scored against Southampton, where it was passed to the goalkeeper, almost under the goalkeeper, before he had a chance to move. Mm. And if you look at the goal at Nottingham, you know, one touch to control it and then picked his spot, bent it round Adam Lallana, as it turned out. But yeah, the number of his shots that go in the corner, low past the keeper, no accident there.
Yeah, it was caressed, wasn't it?
Mm. My point about that goal, actually, and it's another thing that irks me, and we're going to talk about our good friend VAR properly later, I'm sure, was they had a good long check for that to see if Lallana was offside. Now, one, he wasn't. It was only about sort of 6 inches, but he wasn't offside. But two, if he was he really interfering? Did he really, you know, and if that's the case, then we're going back to, you know, the Aston Villa goal that now was about the second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever it was we conceded, where Villa scored one of their goals and one of their players was right on top of Jason Steele. And you're back to the maddening inconsistencies again. Now, I know I've talked about the inconsistencies from one ref to another or from one VAR official to another. And it's, you know, the real maddening stuff is when it's in the same game. But, you know, it would be nice to know as a supporter, as a stakeholder in the game, what the actual laws are on that kind of interference in a goal.
Yeah, well, I think, Vicky, I mean, the problem with the laws as they are, as IFAB have put down, is none of them have been designed to be micromanaged by VAR. So obviously you've got the black and white decisions, which should be like straightforward, but a lot of them, they just haven't got a clue. They're not there to be micromanaged. I mean, offside to stop goal hanging, not to be a Nat's pew offside.
I don't. To be fair, I'm not sure any of them are black and white. At the end of the day, they're laws of the game that have always been designed to be interpreted by humans. The only difference now is that those humans are subject, even before VAR, those humans are subject to a level of scrutiny, you know, since Sky took over the game, but even since cameras came into football to start off with.
Since slow motion replays.
Absolutely. So that's that they've always been subject to, you know, they've always been, an offside. As we now know, an offside is a human decision. We used to think, oh, it's either offside or you're not, but actually now it isn't. If you can slow it down that much, then you know, is it someone's hand that's offside? Is it someone's knee, someone's boot? You know, and then when they say it's the part that you can score with, well, is that bit that's ahead of the line, is that his shirt sleeve or is that his shoulder? And that's the difficulty with it. Do I think referees have got any worse over the years? I don't think they have. They can't have got any worse. What has got bigger is the scrutiny of the game. And I mean, there's been lots of things that have come up as a result of that game. That you could sort of debate, you know, that there's two penalties in there. I mean, the sending off, my personal view, if we're going to talk about the sending off, my personal view, if Lewis Dunker said what he said to the referee, then it's his own stupid fault and he can't argue with it. The most bizarre thing was the statistic that was going around earlier in, you know, yesterday, I think it was, that no player...
One of 16 years.
No player has been sent off for foul and abusive language in the Premier League for 16 years. That is absolutely staggering. Because you've only got to watch a game and you can see them all effing and blinding and calling referees cheats and this. You see it all the time.
Jill now, Scott.
If they're standing there... Personally, I've got no issue with players being sent off for that kind of thing. I think it's petulant, it's pathetic. You know, we all rant and rave, but we're supporters. We can kind of do what we like within reason. But players are on the pitch. They know the rules. If they gob off at referees, they know that they should be in trouble.
Oh, but you see, they don't, do they? Because this is the first time it's happened for 16
years. And this is what blows my mind, that a referee isn't now like, right, you can't, I'm going to send you off for that, which is fine. That's the rules of the game. And if Dunker's done wrong, then he's done wrong. That's his own stupid fault. I've got no sympathy with him. But if this is, what I don't understand is why it hasn't been happening for the last 16 years. I think this Smith was the last one to be sent off for fouling.
Yeah, Alan Smith, yeah.
And people, when they look at it, people are getting confused between dissent and foul and abusive and insulting language. So, you know, there's clearly a difference there. But... you know, no one's been sent off since Alan Smith in 2000. Whatever.
Anyone ever believe that Didier Drogba was all sweetness and light and never, ever, ever swore in front of a referee?
John Terry, or you look at, you know, players of Manchester United or Newcastle, they surround the referee and you can see what they're saying. You know, you see it constantly on the TV. And so why they say, and if they're going to turn around and say, well, we've had a directive to crack down on it this season, it's November. You know?
Yeah. What,
you can't tell me not a single player has sworn at a referee since August, apart from Lewis. What a polite league we live in. And, you know, maybe they're just miming when I see them on the TV going, big peas and whatever else. You know, it just, it's incredible. I wonder if it's just Anthony Taylor's got a bit offended by the personal nature of it, maybe. Yeah, he's right. He's right to do it. It is the correct decision under the laws of the game. Dunk has been stupid, but why on earth are these players...
It would be interesting to know if that's part of a directive to referees to get tough on that sort of thing, or whether he's just a Daily Mail reader who's reacting to their crusade, against, an anti-respect sort of agenda. I mean, I don't think I'm not going to say where I got the information, but I don't believe that Graham Pohl is terribly impressed with his current crop of refereeing talent, as we could say it. I think
even Howard Webb.
The trouble is, it's being watered down by Nick, the whole system. Nick,
did you mean Howard Webb?
Sorry, what did I say?
Graham Pohl, people. No one's impressed with Graham Pohl.
No, Howard Webb. Sorry, yes, he's not. Bleep that. Edit that. I don't think that. And of course, the thing is that the referees are having to do fourth officials' jobs. They're having to be VAR officials as well. You know, and it's once again stretching the pool of available talent, if you regard it as talent. It's very, we used to say, didn't we, that a good referee was one that you hadn't noticed, and if you come off the pitch without having had noticed anything the referee's done, then he had a good game. But the trouble is, he's not just left to have a good game, is he? He's got VAR in his ear, and the whole thing, this being re-refereed, Stockton Park and before he even gets towards the TV.
Well, this goes back to what Vicky was saying earlier, though, doesn't it? Because before VAR, if you look at the stats, obviously you're always going to get the odd howler, but generally speaking, they got, I think it was like 92% of the decisions right.
Yeah, but it's the nature of scrutiny, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's, where we got, this is kind of one of those things of be careful what you wish for. People ask for, errors to be stamped out of the game. The offside thing, these rules were brought in. You've got on several levels. One is, like you say, the toenail that's offside. Two is the people being able to use the technology in the first place. And three is then translating that technology into plain English in a football match, looking at the Liverpool-Spurs game for the sake of argument. Now, yes, you're right. Probably 90% of decisions are correct. And VAR has not so much stopped or started the argument. It's just actually changed the argument and brought it into a greater sense of scrutiny. I mean, you do get on one extreme, you get just bin it, just get rid of it, it's not there, and the others are sort of like, well, you must have more respect for the referees. In between, and this is where Howard Webb has got it absolutely from absolutely everywhere, he's got to sort out a system which, if it works well, is one of those where we think, well, okay, you'll accept the 5% anomalies. But seeing as it's the people, as you say, Nick, the talent pool that he's got to work with, actually needs retraining, a lot of it, isn't it?
But this quest for perfection is a complete chimera. There's absolutely no point in it because, you think about how far back do you go, when a goal's scored to find out, an error or a possible offside or a possible foul and all the and certain things that you can't look at. If there was, the handball that actually takes the ball into goal, yeah, but some of that has to be brought back. But if it just hits someone's hand beforehand, then it doesn't. I mean, there are so many ifs and buts and so many, little things. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. And what are they talking about bringing in? More VAR. Now, the expanding the scope of it for corners, for free kicks. And I'm thinking, misses the point completely.
I can't remember if it was somebody who said somewhere, but this was something that would never be brought in by anybody who's paid to watch a game of football. It's for administrators to feel good about themselves. Anyone who actually pays, buys their own ticket and wants to and watch football and enjoy a game would never want any more of that.
Yeah. No. Okay.
I think, following on really from what Nick said, the problem is it is still only ever going to be a matter of opinions, and you can have as many people sat there as you like. You could have 12 people on the VAR panel And with some things like fouls, like even with handballs, as we've seen already, one person will say, well, it was, you know, it was intentional. One person will say it's not. Oh, well, it's, you know, that's... And then they talk about the levels of force used and is it a foul? So it's a human decision. It's always going to be a human decision. Yeah. That's one thing. And I do think, you know, we know we see mistakes, but I don't want to sit there and be like the referee's friends here, but we are far harsher on judging them than we are on our own players. And therefore, referee will make one mistake in a game and it's a key mistake and one team will go, well, that's cost us the game. It's the worst thing that's ever happened in the world. Oh, we're getting relegated now because of this. You know, you're not getting relegated because of one decision. But what we all completely ignore is all the mistakes the players have made all game long.
Players can't go back and rectify the mistakes, whereas in theory, VAR means that a referee can go back and rectify his mistake. And then when they look at it again and they don't get it wrong, and they don't get it right, rather. I mean, taking it away from the Albion, you think about that Newcastle-Arsenal game, and they're all convinced that they got it right, that the Arsenal defender wasn't pushed by the two hands in the back that I think most fans would say was a push. And so, as Vicky says, it's you're just talking about personal opinion there, and I think it's a personal opinion that most fans would disagree with.
Yeah. Well, we nearly got an example of double jeopardy in this game, because obviously the Forest penalty that got eventually given, the ref gave nothing initially, and then we should have actually scored.
Yeah, I mean, we wasted that chance, didn't I? I think it involved, was it Hinshelwood and somebody else?
Yeah, Hinshelwood at both ends.
Yeah, really nice move. Yeah, it would have been interesting, wouldn't it, to see the reaction, because I think, you know, the penalty up the other end was given in the end, not according to Gary Birtles' rules on Sky, which was interesting. That's a little argument. The former Forest player, Gary Birtles, of course. Yes. But, yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting. That probably would have spiced it up even more, as it is, that, you know, that penalty finally woke their amazing fans up, who actually, until that point, I think they'd been quite passive. So, you know, that suddenly roused them, although not as much as the celebrations at the end did. So.
Yes. We'll come to that in a minute. But I think that at the very least, and it's one of those that people debated when VAR first came in, was that what happens if you're 45 seconds down the line, you know, you carry on playing and the opposition score and then you go back to it. Yes, it would have been annoying. Yes, it would have been infuriating. But I think it's actually one of those, because it's one of those sort of anomalies that was raised right at the very beginning, is one of those where you realise, actually, I think most fans would have accepted it as being part of the law. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing. It's when it's misinterpreted, and I think we've discussed this on the show very briefly, AD. It was the game in Marseille where they played on for about another minute or so. There was a VAR check for a possible penalty to the Albion. And I think that the VAR bloke did very well. Yes, there was a handball, but Van Hekkel was actually climbing all over the bloke. And so therefore, mitigating circumstances, not a... But what happened was that the ball had gone out for a goal kick for the Albion, but the referee had brought it back for a free kick. And that's outside the scope of VAR.
Yeah.
So even then, you know, it should have been actually carry on, because in other words, it's not a penalty. The fact that it's not a penalty because it was a foul is not the point. VAR isn't there to give free kicks. Yeah, it can only adjudicate on penalties. Sorry, Nick?
It's not there yet, but you know, by the time the rules group have finished, it'll be there for everything.
Well, if it's let's hope not. Well, the one goal that didn't need any help from VAR was one from João Pedro, right on the stroke at halftime. Beautiful cross from Pascal Gross. I mean, again, like the Forest opener in the game, you've got to question the defending for it, but it was such a pinpoint header, Vicky.
Oh, it was. It's one of those ones where you look at and think he's got no right to score a header from there, is he? You know, really well placed. I mean, it was just, it felt a bit strange because it felt with both of the goals, it felt in their way and like it was, maybe it was a bit of nerves, but it wasn't quite the sort of high level explosive reaction that you often get with goals. So it was kind of, I think there's definitely a bit of nerves in there. And it was a strange kind of atmosphere for a lot of the game, actually. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, when we got the third goal with the penalty, it was like, oh, actually, that's when things started to, you know, I suppose maybe we relaxed a bit. But
well, obviously, we've already talked about the Alamo at the end where Van Hecker was just immense. And I know you wanted to talk about Van Hecker, Al.
Yeah, nobody beats him. Makes me feel sad for the rest. Nobody does it half as good as him. He's the best. I think what we need to discuss is that just because that's what we do on this show is, were both penalty decisions correct? Notwithstanding Lewis Dunk's red card, yes, he deserved it in his own right. This is where the irritation of a referee's possible double standards is that why was then not Murillo then sent off for a triple jeopardy of running into João Pedro when he'd already been booked, standing on his back and then kicking him in the midriff.
Right in front of the referee's assistant.
And even then they VAR'd it. And you think, well, what on earth were they looking at if it wasn't a sort of a triple assault on him? That's the part of the referee's consistency that drives me around the twist. It's not two referees in two different games. It's the same referee in one game. Foul and abusive language is a red card offence, as Vicky said. Absolutely, there's no question about it. And it's not whataboutery necessarily, because, hey, we won. But let's have them apply. Let's have the laws applied properly. Let's have them applied fairly. I mean, when I say fairly and properly, one goes back to the Arsenal game towards the end of the season last season. Two incidents. Martinelli absolutely clatters into Mitoma. Referee gives a free kick. No yellow card. Probable yellow card, borderline red. Then 5 minutes later, Caicedo absolutely takes down Martinelli. Free kick. No yellow card. At least you see probably two wrongs making a right here for once, where in both instances, both players should have had a yellow card, but they equaled themselves out. And at least you can then see consistent refereeing.
Yeah. I was just a bit confused by the two penalty decisions, really. I mean, I think the one on Pedro, it's a foul in the box. It's whether he's getting there or not, it doesn't make any difference. It was a foul in the box, right? But the one at the other end, it was... So, most of the game, you could see it in glorious HD, and yet for their penalty, no one has got a clear image of it. Not they've been showing everything from multiple angles. Apart from that, no one can actually see what actually happened.
But didn't that one come down to the original decision and no reason to change it? Or am I giving it, like, getting it wrong way around? That's the one he didn't give originally, wasn't
that's
it?
That's the one, yeah, he didn't give it. I think he
was disgusted.
You could see immediately he pointed to his ear and said, I'm going to get someone to look at that. But I suppose if he doesn't give the penalty, it's a stupid thing to say. If he doesn't give the penalty, then he's originally said no penalty. That's the on-field decision. I don't think there's any such thing as no decision. So if anything, it's VAR that's actually gone back to the ref and said, I think you should have a look at this.
Yeah.
To my mind, the bloke has come from behind Hinshelwood, who doesn't necessarily, I'll say he doesn't know he's there. He knows he's there, but I don't think Hinshelwood's done anything. In which case, yes, it's accidental, but I think that the Forest bloke has initiated it, but I'm not really seeing too much of a debate on it. So maybe I'll stand alone on this, and I don't know if it's easier to have seen it in real time at the City Ground or if it's easier to have seen what replays we've had.
With the way the VAR works, basically in real time, the ref has not given it, so it's no penalty.
Has he made it? Under the heading of one of those things, though, they say, well, if you give that, you've got to give 20 penalties in a game. Yeah. It was what they call a coming together in my...
Yeah,
him
not giving the penalty was not, in my opinion, a clear and obvious error. There wasn't enough in there to be.
I didn't see it was a foul at all.
Camera angles to say otherwise. So
I think we've gone a long way away from clear and obvious error. I don't think that seems to matter at all anymore.
Okay, well let's move on from all that because we've got a lot to get through now. But first, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast as ever. We're brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And this is a lovely shirt that Phil's given us to have a look at this week. Who wants to have a go at describing this one, Nick, Vicky?
It's a blue and white one, so obviously in the correct colours. It's got blue shoulders and blue and white, I can only say diagonal stripes going across the chest, and a NetBet sponsor. I've never heard of it. I don't recognise it in any way, shape or form. It looked to me like there is Greek lettering on the badge.
I think I know something about this because I have, I don't know if I mentioned before, I've got a friend who has come since a lifelong Albion fan who collects blue and white striped shirts from all over the world. And I think he's got another version of this club. I can't remember what their name is, but I think they're from Athens.
They are called Atromitos of Athens, also known as Fearless, because that's what Atromitos means.
Because I remember thinking it looked like he had a version of this that looked like the Albion shirt that they wore for the opening of the Amex. And I looked at it closely. I thought that was an Albion shirt. And I saw the badge and it had that star on it. So I thought this must be the same club.
That it is. So there you go. Do you want to put a year on it?
2022.
Yeah. Okay, give up then. Go home. This is your shirt of the week. This is the 2022-2023 home shirt of Greek Super League side Atromitos FC, based in Athens, in the suburb of Peristeri. And they play at the 8,969 capacity Peristeri Stadium. The side was formed in 1923 by local students, and the influence of a university lecturer enabled them to become recognised by the Panhellenic Football League, and the following year they joined the league. In that first ever season, they finished third behind Panathinaikos and AEK Athens. While the side has never won the Super League, they have had several Division 2 and 3 league titles to their name, and they have been runners-up twice in the Greek Cup, and the current run in the Super League extends back to 2009. The current squad includes players from 14 countries, which includes no one you've ever heard of, and only one who has ever played in the UK, a certain Laurens de Bock, a Belgian left-back who played 7 times for the Dirty Leeds in 2018.
I wonder if the stripes go around the back as well, like a sort of blue and white barber's pole. That'd be good.
Oh, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Links to the UK include Chris Cole, who has managed the side from 2022 until last month, and Henri Camara, who played for Wolves, Celtic, Southampton, Wigan, West Ham, Stoke and Sheffield United before moving to Athens in 2010. Sadly, no link to the Albion, although he will be visiting their club shop when he's in Athens to pick up one of their smart-looking centenary shirts. So thank you for that, Phil. Of course, you can see that and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com. Right, before we move on, I've just got one thing on the notice board. Next Tuesday, that's the 7th of December, there is a show going on at the Amex. It is part of the BT. Actually, Al, you mentioned the last one, which they did at the Forge. It's a show called The Football's On, which is presented by Ian Stone, and it features a very recent guest of ours, a certain Mr. Stephen Grant, and also BT Sport presenter Jules Breach. Tickets are just a fiver, and you can get along there to the Amex and have a good time watching that. So moving swiftly on, Vicky, you loved the bedlam at the end of the game, didn't you?
I did. I've got bruises on my shins, I've been finding in the past few days. Amazing.
That's a fine for not wearing shin pads at all times.
I've got shin pads, they're just like really small ones.
You nicked them from Jack Grealish. Oh, I get it.
Socks.
No, it was really, really good, actually. It was fantastic. And we all saw I think De Zerbi was pretty much in the penalty area before the whistle had even finished blowing, because I think he saw the ref's hand go up and you saw a couple of players like punching the air. And he was off like a rat up a drainpipe to the away fan. It was kind of jumping up and down, a bit like the Leo Ajoa game, let's call it that, at the City Ground as well. Sorry, the world-famous City Ground. That's what we've been rebranded. But yes, it was a lot of jumping around. And clearly that's upset a few people at Nottingham Forest. I'm not really sure why. I think I feel that there's a little bit of, we've lost the game, so we'll just whinge about something here. You know, I'm sure that they went back and shook some hands afterwards. Do they really want to? I think there's a little bit of xenophobia probably from Steve Cooper as well. You know, this is the British way. We shake hands. We don't rub it in when we win. I'm pretty sure I've seen Steve Cooper running around and rubbing it in when his team have won before. So, frankly, he can poke it, because it was amazing in the away end. It was absolute scenes, as they call it. My shins are still recovering. And the other thing is, it's not like a single Albion player ran to the home support. You know, it's not even like Morpay running along the Palace fans with his hand cut to his ear. They literally, the whole lot, the whole team, the people on the bench, they all ran to the away fans and they celebrated in front of the away fans. There was no giving it to the Forest fans. It was just us and the players, and it was brilliant.
And a GPS.
And a GPS, which has now been retrieved, thankfully.
But does it, but hang on, do those celebrations justify homophobia?
Well, this semi, apparently it seems so, according to that Forest fans group, doesn't it? But
Proud Forest, yeah.
Proud Forest fans group, which seemed to be sort of saying, well, you can understand why they were being homophobic, because, you know, the Brighton fans were celebrating. Absolute rubbish.
I think Proud Forest have slightly dissociated themselves from that today, although they did mention the celebrations, which really have nothing to do with it either way, you'd have to say.
Why would you know it? Because they blocked me on Twitter, X, whatever.
Very dare they.
Out that actually it was a little bit, you know, either it is homophobic or it isn't. You can't give them mitigation because they're a bit hurty because they've just lost a game.
Yeah.
On the business of the world-famous City Ground, I remember Jose Mourinho told a story where he'd come to Britain and visited the City Ground because he said he wanted to see where those... The team that had won those two European Cups had come from, and he went to the City Ground and thought, this is the ground of a team that won two European Cup finals. So,
I think actually, to be fair, as you said earlier, I mean, it's a club that's won nothing before and afterwards, and, you know, apart from so their major glory is under Brian Clough. And let's face it, I mean, obviously they've always been a bigger club than the Albion, for instance. They're certainly an older club, and they've been around for a lot longer, and they're in a, you know, sort of Midlands, North City, which is kind of where football really came from in this country. Yeah, it's, I mean, I think they're not the same size as they are bigger, but yeah. You can actually, if you rewind that 40 years or fast forward the 40 years, then Brighton will probably be about the equivalent size club now. So it just underlines the achievement of Forest winning the European Cup twice. You know, if you can imagine Brighton winning the Champions League twice in a row, that's the level of achievement we're talking about, in which case you think, well, fair enough.
Yeah. Now, funnily enough, earlier this month, I was at a ground where the side had won the European Cup four times. That was, of course, in Amsterdam. And this week, Vicky, you are off to Athens to see a side that's never won the European Cup. But it is a brilliant place to go. It's so exciting for us to actually go there, isn't it?
Well, it is. I've never been to Athens. And as I said earlier, this is my first European away game. So I am very excited. It's not a bad place to be going, is it? I know they're not a club that have, you know, themselves won loads of sort of European trophies, but it's a city with lots of culture, lots of history. It could perhaps have picked a better week for the government to get involved in a dispute about the Elgin Marbles, but... we did. I think someone suggested on Twitter earlier, maybe we could kind of all smuggle bits of them back with us, and then maybe they'll give us the points if we were to sort of each smuggle a bit of marble.
Well, no, we have to nick them from the British Museum, which is and then sort of hand them back to them. What was it? Let donkey score, you can have your marbles back.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think that sounds like the sort of for a good movie plot, actually. Rob the British Museum and then smuggle them back to Athens.
Starring Ryan Reynolds and probably Idris Elba.
I was thinking more Sid James and Kenneth.
That is something I might pay to go to the cinema to see.
The Ghost of Sid James.
But, yeah. Meanwhile, back on the pitch, yeah, Ajax are currently sitting third in the Greek Super League. 1-2, drawn one of the last three. Obviously, they beat us at the Amex with a game. I think we were still finding our feet, Vicky, in that particular game.
Yeah, I think for me, the concern is that they are exactly the sort of side that we don't really like playing against. I feel like they looked in that game at the Amex a bit of a Sean Dyche side. And I don't mean that to be detrimental. It's just in terms of the way they played, you know, a lot of trying to slow the game down, quick breaking. Not particularly sort of flowing football, you would say. I think it looked a decent side, but I think, you know, we were disappointed with how it went. And I felt like, yeah, they were the sort of side that, yeah, do you know what? We'll sit back. You want to play, but you've got to break us down. And I think hence the kind of Sean Dyche thing in my mind. So interesting to see how they play at home, because they need points, don't they? So
yeah. Now, Nick, I mean, obviously, because they beat us at Yamex, the head-to-heads in this competition are very important. So, and to go over there and like win would give us a really good chance of finishing top of the group.
Yeah, let's try and not concede a goal in the first 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, fair enough. If we could hold Ajax to not scoring twice, that shows that, you know, we're doing something right in Europe, even if we can't do it in the league. It's going to be a question of how many fit bodies there are. Yeah, isn't it? Let's be honest. So, I mean, I don't know who's starting. Who can play? Dunk can play. No Van Heck. Don't know if Balapa's going to start.
Mode is ineligible, apparently.
No need to win it in the first half. No need to win it in the first hour. Let's perhaps see what Ajax have got and take it. What am I saying? Of course, De Zerbi's not going to play cautiously. I don't know. Perhaps there's a case for not attacking them too much and seeing what they've got first and betting our new selection, which I'm sure it will be. I'm sure it'll be an 11 that's never played together before, and just, you know, taking it easy to start with.
Why is Modder not available?
Well, do you have to name a squad for the competition? And I think because he was so far off being match fit at the start of the season, they said, not worth it. He could, if we qualify for the next round, they will rename the squad and he could be in it then.
Yeah, I mean, we should be able to put some release the spine of the team together. I mean, Dahoud and Gross in the middle is not a horrific pairing, is it? So, is Webster going to be ready? Is Eagle going to be ready?
Sooner or later, Gross has got to have a rest, though, hasn't he?
He doesn't feel like it, does he? Well, let's face it.
Gross played an awful lot as well.
Yeah, but don't forget, it's not as though he's not encumbered by speed, though. The same worries that you have over Lamptey and his burst of pace is not something Gross ever has to worry about.
Yeah. At some point as well, I'd actually like to see. I mean, I know we're managing his minutes. I know he's injury prone, but the fact that Lallana only lasted 45 minutes at Forest, maybe that means that he could do another 45, 60 minutes in Athens.
Was that tactical, though, because of the. I don't know exactly how it works, but where you have there's only a set number of windows you can use to make subs, and because subs in the first half, therefore I didn't know if the Lallana thing was more tactical. Has anything been said about him being injured? I know it's Lallana, so he probably is, but
no, there were a few reports that sort of assumed he was injured, but I don't think that there was any indication that he was. I mean, I'm all for playing Lallana for 45 minutes and getting 45 good minutes out of him and then not giving him another 5 minutes to get injured in the second half. Mm-hmm. He's another of those guys who you've got to manage carefully. And you know, perhaps we could have wished that Lamptey and Nestipian had been managed a bit more carefully as well. So if we're preserving Lallana's minutes, I think that could be a good thing.
I think it's probably just easier to assume that when we're looking at the team sheet, everyone's injured, and then realise that the 11 that starts probably isn't. But I only say probably.
Not as injured.
Not as injured, yeah.
Well, we'll see how many kids there are on the bench, because they didn't have to be.
Well, actually, that's something. It's interesting you say that. When I saw the team lineup against Forest, and I thought, well, it's not too shabby a lineup. Do we know if Matoma's going to be ready, back ready? So you see the lineup, it's not too bad. And then you saw the bench, and you thought, well, okay, Baliba, who's still sort of getting up to speed, Pedro, who at the moment I think we're relying on a bit too much for sort of energy up front. And after that, it was basically kids. I mean, Modder was coming back, but yeah, we had Hinshelwood and Buonanotte, who still needs to raise his game for me a little bit. And then we're into, like you say, Doofus. And
good, interesting player, Doofus. You know, very skillful on the ball. Seen a lot of the other 21s this season. And I think that him, Luca Barrington, obviously Mark Armani. You know, there's some good forward talent there. And Doofus can you know, might be a good option later in the game to hang on to the ball and, you know, dribble around a few people. And interesting that, you know, he's had a couple of the under-21s on the bench for each of the last two games. It'd be interesting to see which ones he picks for Thursday, because I'm assuming he's going to have to.
We saw a fantastic performance from those kids against Celtic last week as well, didn't we?
Well, we kind of did. We saw a great 30 minutes to start with, and then Celtic got back into the game and they scored a tremendous equaliser, and you thought that it was Celtic going to win, but they have managed to recover themselves. And Louis Flower, the guy they got from Chelsea, came on and scored a really good goal towards the end, having just missed one a little bit earlier, you know, which could have damaged his confidence. So, no, I think we've got some interesting forward talent there. Not entirely sure about some of the defenders, but, they're looking good. Well, I mean, yeah, yes, once again, also incapable of keeping a clean sheet.
Exactly. Cracking game, though. Right, well, we're just getting to, towards the end of the show, but Vicky, probably a little bit sort of personal stuff for you. You actually went on a holiday just to find out how many fans there are of the Albion winger.
I've just got back from Japan, so I thought it would be rude not to take my Matoma branded away shirt with me. And it was quite nice because, you know, I think, you know, three times within the first hour or so, I had people coming up to me and sort of, yeah, not necessarily speaking much English. And I don't speak much Japanese. But you know, they were pointing at the shirt and sort of Matoma. So there was kind of a non-speaking conversation that went on several times. So that was quite nice. So it was nice to have that, you know, sort of something in common, I suppose, on my travels.
Absolutely. You travel 10,000 miles around the world and you realise actually you've got something majorly in common with most of the population of the people there, and that's your love of Kaoru Matoma. It's just actually for me, I mean, obviously it's the experience that you've had, but, you know, sitting back as someone obviously didn't go, it's just kind of one of those head scratches. We had the Americans on last week. It's one of those head scratches that here we are, Ickle Brighton. There's four of us talking across Zoom in Sussex. And yet here we are. We are, not to the size of Liverpool or Man United, Nick, a global brand that I think we're actually still coming to terms with, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a proud native Brightonian who's always sort of bigged up my home city and the Albion, I'm thinking that finally people are cottoning on to what I've always believed in my heart of hearts, an unfounded belief that the Albion are the greatest football club in the entire world, and the Brighton Hove Albion is the only city worth living in. So I don't know. Maybe I'm the wrong person to ask. I don't have that inferiority complex about the Albion and beautiful Brighton that some people do.
Well, I certainly met a load of people in Holland that are very much on the Albion side as well, and the Dutch Seagulls are growing as well. And maybe we'll find some Greek ones to join them after, hopefully, a victory in Athens on Thursday. But that is all we've got time for this week. So thank you so much, as usual, to Alan Ware. Thank you to Vicky Rees. Thank you to Nick Trepanic. I've been AD Packham, and this has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on a podcast, and in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye.
Stay close by me and hold tight, sing and shout, just wrap around about and hold tight, shut your eyes, girl, you set me up for Zion.
Just wrap around the calendar. Catch a rest. Will you set me up for Zion?